You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Howard Yaris. He's an economist, professor, attorney, businessman, and activist. He currently teaches at New York University. He previously served as executive vice president and general counsel at the Radian Group, one of the largest guarantors of debt in the world. He's here to discuss his award-winning book, Understandable Economics, because understanding our economy is easier than you think and more important than you know. Welcome to the Exchange, Howard.
Thank you. Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing great. Now, just give me a moment to set up my first question, if you will. I live in Southern Oregon, surrounded by mountains, lakes, and streams. It's a scenic place where many people come to retire after spending much of their lives working elsewhere. That migration is a key factor that contributes to rising costs in less affordable places to live here, and that has a cascading effect. This is just one aspect of how our lives here in Southern Oregon are impacted by economic factors. But if I asked the average student to explain the regional economy here, most couldn't, and I doubt if many adults could either. So let's start from the beginning. What's the first thing that we should be teaching our kids to help them understand economics and their local economy, and at what age?
That's a great question. And the first step, the step I always emphasize, is to not focus on math or jargon or formulas, is to look at the world. And you gave me a perfect example of that. You see people moving to your area, wanting to live there. It has a lot of attributes that people like. So what happens when more people move in and the number of people moving in exceeds the growth in the housing stock? Prices go up. You don't need any special formulas for that. And so you see rising prices. And so one obvious way to bring prices down in the long run is to provide more housing, which might, in fact, take away some of the benefits that people are seeking out in Southern Oregon. But that's one way to begin exploring how to bring down housing costs, if that's a priority. But again, this is something that just carefully observing what's going on in the world should enable you to understand what, in fact, is going on.
Well, I always think of economics as the way the flow of money and access to money impacts our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the right way to think about it?
I think of that as finance. Finance deals with money, money flows. Economics is the bigger picture. What happens to resources? What happens to the land and the resources and all of the stuff the economy produces? Again, finance deals with the dollars. Economics is a much broader picture. It takes into account everything, including what's happening with housing in Southern Oregon.
Okay. Well, let's get started with your book. Can you read an excerpt?
Absolutely. I'll read this excerpt. Just like psychology, economics is a social science. In fact, this is just what we were discussing. It's an attempt to understand human interactions and how they affect the world around us. It focuses on those relationships as they relate to money, as well as the goods, services, and resources money buys. In order to tease out some precision regarding those relationships, professional economists use data and mathematical tools. But the fundamental relationships themselves should become apparent if you're willing to observe the world carefully and apply your own common sense. The goal of my book is to help you do that. The need for this understanding is more important now than ever. The belief that our economic system is failing is at a record high, and for good reason. Incomes are stagnating, middle-class jobs are disappearing, the economy is growing more slowly, and the meager gains produced are almost exclusively going to those who are already well off. There's been a wide range of reactions to these economic changes, from Occupy Wall Street to the election of Donald Trump. What is the one thing all of these reactions have in common? They have not resulted in any significant positive change in the lives of most Americans. As people often correctly say, democracy is not a spectator sport. Its health, our health, depends upon the participation of well-informed people, like the people listening to this show.
Well, Howard, most of us haven't been taught how to exercise our agency in shaping the democratic process and the economy that surrounds us. We've kind of been conditioned to seek enjoyment and pleasure and the perks that come with spending money and time on our self-interests. Why should we care who's pulling the levers of power that impact our local economic ecosystems?
Because they greatly affect us. Economics is really about values. I'll give you an example that everyone can get their head around: taxes. How high should taxes be? There's no magical formula that you plug in all of this data and come out with a perfect tax rate. It's a judgment call as to how much each of us should have to contribute to the common good. And so that's a question that can only be answered on a societal level. It's an answer that we can only come up with by getting a consensus around people regarding what's fair. And so if you just cede those decisions to some quote-unquote experts or politicians or whomever, you may very well not get the result that you like. And so it's critically important, again, that we all get involved in this, because if we don't, we may very well get the policies and the answers that go against everything we believe.
Okay, so as we're growing up, we're not being taught economics in K-12, at least certainly not in elementary school. And in most high schools, I'm not sure whether or not economics is mandatory. But let's define our terms. We talk about living in a capitalist society, which governs our economic systems. What is capitalism? And also, why is there such a fear of socialism, communism, Marxism, and other isms that aren't capitalism?
There are a lot of isms out there, and discussing them really doesn't get, in my humble opinion, us any closer to understanding what's going on in the real world. The way to get a better sense of what's going on in the real world is to look closely at the real world. And let's take two countries, America and North Korea. North Korea is described as communist. We're described as capitalist. Namely, each country has plenty of private businesses, and each country has plenty of government involvement in business. In America, the government's involved, literally a partner in every business through the tax system. There are an incredible number of regulations, some of which we can all agree on regarding clean water and clean air, and some of which are questionable. But the point is that every functioning society is somewhere along the spectrum of private enterprise and public regulation as a question of where on the spectrum you are. Talking about it theoretically doesn't really answer any questions. Looking at the real world and seeing what works best, what regulation works best, when the government should step back and let private enterprise have its way, that's how you get to a better society, not by discussing theory that really has only limited applicability to what's going on.
My guest is Howard Yaris. He teaches at New York University and is the author of an award-winning book, Understandable Economics, because understanding our economy is easier than you think and more important than you know. Howard, what is creative destruction and why does it matter?
Creative destruction is a term used to refer to industries like the buggy whip industry. There were people whose job it was to make buggy whips before cars came in. Cars came in, they're out. That's what creative destruction is. We created a new industry, namely automobiles, and destroyed an old industry that it displaced, people who made buggy whips. And are we better off or worse off? And I would argue that most of the time we're quite better off. Something good displaces something that's become obsolete. And so that happens all the time in a capitalist economy. And if you didn't have it, we'd still be going around in horse-drawn buggies rather than automobiles. And let me just add something. Automobiles are far from perfect. They're better than horse-drawn buggies, but maybe creative destruction will come up with something even better than automobiles in the near future. That's the whole point of creative destruction. Something is displaced by something better.
Okay, well, let's talk about being displaced. AI is exponentially accelerating the pace of innovation around the world, as well as the pace of obsolescence. And you mentioned the buggy whip. But it comes at a significant cost. Here in Oregon, we're one of the top 10 states for tech data centers that require extraordinary amounts of energy to sustain. And we forget that the cloud isn't an actual cloud. It's a data center or a network of data, network of data centers, and they house enormous amounts of content that we produce. And now, AI is producing content at a rate that far outpaces human capacity, and yet it's us humans who have to pay the utility companies for the energy that sustains the cloud. And the utility companies have to respond to that growing demand for energy, which they're struggling to do here in Oregon. So where's this headed from an economic perspective?
Well, as we discussed about real estate in Oregon, to the extent there's more demand, there's a higher price. And the demand for energy is growing enormously because of these AI data centers. They're heavy users of energy. And so it's going to raise the energy prices for all of us. On the other hand, AI is providing a service that presumably a lot of people want. Again, economics always involves trade-offs. There's usually not a right or wrong answer. And that's why through our political process, we need to assert our values so that the outcome is appropriate, so that data centers have some kind of regulations that they don't eat up, entire electric grids. And that AI growth can be useful to people and not jump ahead and cause all sorts of unintended harmful consequences.
So AI and technology also use supply chains from around the world where rare earth minerals and other resources, as you mentioned earlier, economics is about resources and control of those resources. And we're accessing those resources from all over the place because they're not here where we are. They're in other people's countries. And so given that we're being fueled by this fast-paced technology race and we need the supply chains, the raw resources that provide the hardware that we need, how does that impact international relations? How does that impact populations, particularly vulnerable populations?
Well, I'll go out on a limb. I think generally that's a great thing. It's a great thing that nations rely on other nations for supplies or inputs into whatever they're doing. The average automobile has inputs, I once read, from almost 80 countries. The fact that we all have to cooperate and supply each other with goods to produce all sorts of things we need and want, I think it's a good thing that nations respect and rely on each other. That said, sometimes there are critical things like the rare earth minerals or nuclear technology that you really can't outsource because it makes your nation vulnerable. It impacts national security. So I think sometimes there's an argument that we need our own domestic production capacity for certain things like certain armaments, the rare earth minerals that are essential in certain things. But for most things, and generally, I think this international cooperation on producing goods is a good thing. I think it theoretically could reduce tension and conflicts when nations realize they rely on each other. And I'll add one other thing. It makes production more efficient. The fact is that Bangladeshis can make pajamas a lot cheaper than we can, and we can make planes much more efficiently than they can. So it makes sense that we trade pajamas for airplanes and have international trade in that way.
Well, I appreciate your optimism. Unfortunately, there's a lot of countries on the African continent which are rich in resources, cobalt and nickel and diamonds and gold and so on and so forth. And the cooperation that you are talking about doesn't seem to have materialized in these dominant nations that desire those resources.
Yes, and I think with regard to certain things like these rare earth minerals and certain other, I mentioned nuclear technology, the United States needs either a domestic source or a completely reliable foreign source. It's risky to rely on a supplier that's politically unstable or that may in fact become adversarial. So that is a total reason. That's an excellent reason for developing domestic production of those critical elements. But most things are not so critical, or we can ramp up pretty quickly. So I think when, for most things, international trade is arguably a very good thing.
Okay, well, on that note, we're going to have to take a short break. I'll be right back with my guest, Howard Yaris, author of Understandable Economics, because understanding our economy is easier than you think and more important than you know. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Howard Yaris. He teaches at New York University and is the author of an award-winning book, Understandable Economics, because understanding our economy is easier than you think and more important than you know. Howard, why is our economic system creating greater inequality?
Well, there are two reasons, I think. One is that if you look back in the 1800s, how did you listen to music? You couldn't pop in a CD. Actually, that's obsolete, too. You couldn't go online and stream it and hear great music from a few international superstars. You had to go to your local music hall. Every city of any size had a music hall and employed singers and musicians and ushers and all sorts of people. So there was this enormous infrastructure of people involved in music production. Now you have a few super-duper international celebrities that have an infinite number of downloads from one great performance. So they're making a ton of money that was used to be divided among all these people in all these cities who are involved in music. So that it's concentrated. It's more of a winner-take-all economy. I always use the example of in the 1950s. I knew friends of my parents had a store that sold clothing, and they wanted to open up one in California, and it was just too complicated and expensive, the long-distance phone calls, the figuring out what was going on in San Francisco. Now Amazon, Jeff Bezos, could sell anything anywhere in the world with the cost-free platform of the Internet. So it's allowed the good providers or the best providers to become bigger than ever. The term I use for it in the book is the winner-take-all economy. There's more economies of scale. The best providers get to dominate in the way that they couldn't when there are more costs, transactional costs, to doing business on a huge global scale.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned the 1800s. I'm going to take us back a little further back than that. When Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776, he wasn't writing from the perspective of the 500-plus indigenous nations that existed on this continent at that time, nor was he writing from the perspective of the various African nations from which the Europeans were extracting free labor that they transported to the Americas. And to this day, when researchers and journalists speak about the economy, it's almost always through a Eurocentric lens, with little regard to how economic policies impact the most vulnerable populations who've inherited generations of economic trauma and hostility. So when we talk about inequality, this whole thing was built on a foundation of inequality, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. To the extent that everyone earned the same thing, no one would go to work. You just can't have a significantly productive economy if we all earn the same thing. There must be some level of inequality to incent people to go to work and be creative. That said, this ties back to something we were discussing at the very beginning, how we divide up the incredible bounty our economy has turned out, $30 trillion of goods and services a year, is not something that you can get out of a formula. It's not, there is no economist that can give you a definitive, correct answer as to how that should be divided up. I and your listeners need to get involved in the process so that that division is made in a way that reflects our values, that reflects what we think is fair. And if we don't get involved, the decisions are going to be made, as I said before, by someone else who may or may not share our values. So, yes, it's great to have a lot of stuff. It's great to have a lot of wealth. But we have to make sure that it's divided up and that the rules of the game are things that we view as fair and equitable.
I love that you went down this path, and I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. When the system of capitalism was established in America, It was established on a foundation of racial hierarchy, valuing and devaluing humans by this mythological construct of race and white supremacy. And the nation acknowledged then that it was a whites-only national citizenry. And people were trying to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
and they succeeded They did succeed. Slavery is they didn't completely succeed, but so much progress has been made since then. You know, obviously, most obviously, slavery has been abolished. And the important point to realize is that we're not done. This is why I keep emphasizing we have to get involved. We're far from perfect. And the only way we've improved is by people fighting for improvement. Slavery just didn't end. The Southerners didn't just say, well, we'll free the slaves. They only did it after enormous pressure was put on them. So we as people, you know, Americans, need to put that kind of pressure on our government to push it in a direction that we think is fairer, more equitable.
100%. Following the Civil War, there were radicals in Congress who centered and prioritized the economic and political empowerment of Black people for the very first time in history. Mm-hmm. But it triggered more than 100 years of violent backlash. So getting involved means that people who want to sustain the status quo are also going to be involved as well. And this is the inherited condition of the country that we got from a 20th century of racialized segregationist policies and practices. And now today, 80% of all the employers are white. 92% of that $30 trillion GDP you're talking about is produced by America's white population. More than 90% of all private lands are white-owned. 75% of the entire inventory of America's 146 million homes are owned by America's white population. How can we speak to transforming America's economic system without centering the transformation of the economic lens around race, just as Congress did?
And you left out that the average white household has 9 times the wealth of the average Black household. So, yes, all of those statistics are true. But my question to you is, what's the alternative for not fighting for improvement? To have a monarchy? Do you want the current occupant of the White House making all the decisions as to who gets what and who does what?
Ooh,
it's imperfect. We have a democratic system, and people with goodwill need to get involved. Again, or else the decisions that are being made they may find them very troublesome. There has been enormous improvement, notwithstanding all those statistics. There has clearly been enormous improvement and enfranchisement over the past few hundred years. And I'm an eternal optimist. You picked up on that. It's incumbent on all of us to fight for a better and fairer system. But the system itself, what's the alternative? I wish there were an alternative. Having the occupant of the White House making all these decisions, no. I don't think that would improve things. I think what would improve things is to look at the system, say we've made some progress, let's build on it. And that's the intent of the book, to give people the foundational knowledge to understand these concepts better and to make constructive contributions to the public policy.
My guest is Howard Yaris, author of an award-winning book, Understandable Economics, because understanding our economy is easier than you think and more important than you know. I 100% agree that we have to all get involved. Aren't the folks who are benefiting from the status quo also getting involved and pushing back to sustain the status quo, or worse, revert back?
More than ever. And Citizens United is a Supreme Court case that said that corporations can put unlimited money into the political system. And that's just poisoning. I think that's one of the main reasons our politics is becoming poisoned.
Tell me about corporations. You write about corporations. Tell me about them.
Corporations are the way we learned about them in law school. They're fictional individuals. They're just made up for the purposes of doing a business. And to say they have rights, such as rights to get involved in the political process and fund the political process, I think is just wrong. And I think people, human beings, the 340 million Americans, need to do what they need to do to reverse that. That's what the Supreme Court said, and that's what they felt is appropriate under current law. And I think we need to put pressure on our elected representatives to change that law, to say that politics is for human beings, it's for Americans, not for these fictional individuals that are set up solely to conduct business.
So politics and economics are inseparable.
Inseparable.
As MLK would say, inextricably twined.
Absolutely. And the way you affect economics is through the political system. Again, it's a very rich country, and that's great. We all have to look at that and say that's an achievement. But again, how would that wealth, how that $30 trillion a year is divided up, that's subject to the political system, most obviously through the tax system. And again, there are no answers, and the answers no right answers. And it's a judgment call that reflects values. And to the extent people are not involved, they're going to get decisions they may really not like. And there's no alternative. And yes, it's unfortunate there hasn't been more progress for people who've gotten the short end of the stick for generations. But what's the alternative to what I'm advocating for people to get involved and try to push the ship in a better direction? What's the alternative? I don't see one.
No, I agree with you. I don't think there is an alternative. Folks who were brought here in ships and chains have been fighting to disrupt the status quo because there is no alternative. That being said, when you talk about economics and values, this notion of racial hierarchy is an ideology that values and devalues humans by this mythological construct of race. And the Claremont Institute has produced volumes of scholarship over the past decade arguing that multiculturalism is an existential threat to America. And the default assumption is America is white. And the Heritage Foundation and Project 2025 embraced the Claremont Institute's ideological viewpoint, and Vice President J.D. Vance recently doubled down when he spoke at Claremont this past summer. So is Eurocentric capitalism the right economic system for a multicultural, multiracial society that's still dominated by a white male power structure 250 years from its founding?
Well, let me just say that there are many people who don't agree with that at all. The Heritage Foundation, the head of the Heritage Foundation, just endorsed a talk with someone who said Adolf Hitler was a good guy. So in my opinion, they have no credibility. When you say, is the system that we have one that's desirable or one that's going to allow for progress, I go back to what I said a moment ago. What's the alternative? To have the occupant in the White House making all these decisions? Do you really think that would help matters?
No, I don't. You're preaching to the choir.
My point is that you try to get people like Obama or Biden or Kennedy. I guess that's from the way back. People like that, they're far from perfect. But again, you don't undo an unjust system overnight. You push in the right direction. And my hope is that over the years, people will push even harder and faster in the right direction and we'll get a better society. But to throw the whole system out, you know, chaos, who gets hurt most in chaos? It's the disadvantage. It's the people with the least agency. Chaos is worst for people who are lower on the economic spectrum and lower on the totem pole. It's through having a good system of rules that are fair and equitable and having the right people in office who care about helping the downtrodden. I think that's the way to progress. Again, it's not immediate, but it's the path to progress. Destroying things, I really don't think that's going to help anyone, particularly those lower down on the totem pole.
Okay. In the last 60 seconds that we have, I have 13 and 14-year-old boys. What do you want me to teach them about economics?
To look carefully at the world, you need to have some foundational knowledge, like what the Fed does, what exactly the Fed does and how it affects the economy and their lives in particular, and to use their head and their heart to think about what policies would help them and help people they respect, and then to get involved in the political situation at the very least, listen to the people running for office and vote for the people who espouse the policies that they agree with, and try to think through if they're going to be faithful in office to those policies, and to not be silent, to stand up for what they think is right.
I love it. We prioritize, just like the radicals in 1865, we prioritize the most vulnerable populations in our society, and we try to lift them up first. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you so much. This was great. I really enjoyed it.
My guest was Howard Yaris. He teaches at New York University and is the author of an award-winning book, Understandable Economics, because understanding our economy is easier than you think and more important than you know. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.